Welcome to episode 91 of the Unstoppable Podcast with special guest, Dr. Meg John Barker. My name is Dan J. Gregory, and I am committed to hunting down the secrets of business mastery and human performance. My goal for the Unstoppable Podcast is to share insights from some of the most successful entrepreneurs, inspiring thought leaders, world-class athletes, and prominent celebrities to help you to become unstoppable in business and life. Each week, I'll be bringing you a new interview with an inspiring person and sharing my own results as I pursue the answers to the question, how can I create the ultimate edge in my business, make a significant impact, and live an extraordinary life? Hello, and welcome to episode 91 of the Unstoppable Podcast and the very final part of the New Year Transformation Series. I know what you're thinking, Dan. It's February already. How the heck are you still talking about the new year? Well, firstly, I'm not ready to wish life away, and time will pass anyway, so I'm going to enjoy the moment. But more importantly than that, transformation takes time. So putting one episode out on the 1st of January simply doesn't cut it. Plus, I wanted to be sure to cover all bases. Now, we've touched on goals, spirituality, finances, health, and business. So now it's time to talk about perhaps the most important area, relationships. Now, most of the time, this show is focused on how to build a successful business in the face of what seems to be an almost shocking failure rate, which has been very well documented in the public eye. However, I wouldn't be surprised to find that the failure rate in relationships is in fact similar, if not worse. It's certainly less documented and probably far harder to measure. However, our intimate relationships can have a profound impact on our overall quality of life. So cracking the code of what makes a quote-unquote successful relationship is absolutely vital. And unlike business, which is limited to only those who've had the courage to start an entrepreneurial venture, most of us have had at least some experience when it comes to intimate relationships, no matter how successfully those relationships may have been. And therefore, all of us have some perspective and perhaps some intense feelings, some of you, about the topic. So, despite a deep knowledge of human behavior when it comes to business and high performance, I do not consider myself in any form an expert when it comes to intimate relationships. I've certainly had my own experiences. However, like you, some of those are positive and some of those are very negative. So, to help us delve into this topic more effectively, I sought out an expert who has dedicated their professional career to understanding relationships. In fact, I found our guest by complete accident whilst researching some concepts around the future of the personal development industry, and I'm glad that I did in order to complete this New Year transformation puzzle and cover all bases today with relationships and, in fact, sex as well. I'm proud to introduce you today to our guest, Dr. Meg John Barker, MJ for short. MJ is a writer, therapist, and activist academic specializing in sex, gender, and relationships. Meg John is a senior lecturer in psychology at the Open University and has published many academic books and papers on topics including non-monogamous relationships, sadomasochism, counseling, and mindfulness, as well as co-founding the journal Psychology and Sexuality and the activist research organization By UK. Dr. Meg John prefers to be referred to in non-binary gender terms and addressed via the pronoun they, them, or their. So when I tell you about MJ's books, for example, you'll hear me say they are the author of Rewriting the Rules, for example, rather than she slash he is the author of Rewriting the Rules. So on that basis, their popular books include the anti-self-help relationship book, Rewriting the Rules, The Secrets of Enduring Love with Jackie Gabb, Queer, A Graphic History with Julia Steele, and Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To with Justin Hancock. They were the lead author of Bisexuality, the Bisexuality Report, which has informed the UK policy and practice around bisexuality, and they are currently co-editing a book on non-binary gender with similar aims in that area too. They are involved in running many public events on sexuality and relationships, including Sense About Sex and Critical Sexology. Meg John is a UKCP accredited psychotherapist working specifically with gender, sexuality, and relationship diverse clients. Now, to give you a heads up on today's session, we are talking about human relationships here, including gender and sex. So if you aren't ready to have an adult conversation where we talk about adult concepts, then please do skip to a different episode. You will hear words like penis, vagina, and penetration. And if you just giggled, it's okay. It's probably that inner child inside of you, which is a good thing, by the way. Or it could be that talking about sex and sexual terms makes you feel uncomfortable. And if so, I do encourage you specifically to be bold, because this episode may be just what you need. So with that disclaimer taken care of, let's dive into the discussion. Here's what we're going to be talking about today: how to understand and embrace your partner's sexual preferences in a relationship, how to use love languages to develop a deeper understanding of how to express love to your partner and why your partner may express love in a different way to you, how greater vulnerability can help resolve conflicts in relationships, how to be your complete authentic self within a relationship without the need for compromise, and how to break down the barriers and address sexual incompatibility in your relationship. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Meg John Barker today to talk about relationships and sex. Let's get into it. MJ, welcome to the Unstoppable Podcast. I'm delighted to have you here as my guest today. For the listeners, obviously, I've just given your kind of academic background. Would you mind us sharing a little bit about your background, how you got into the work you're doing right now, and where your kind of journey all began?
Absolutely. So I guess now I would say I'm primarily a writer of self-help style books, but it's definitely been a long journey getting there. I mean, I was always fascinated by human beings. So I started with a psychology degree and then I carried on to a PhD. But I always found that psychology didn't quite have the answers I was looking for. So I ended up doing a lot more sort of sociology after that. And then I trained as a therapist and I actually did existential therapy, which is a very philosophical approach to therapy. Amazing. So I guess I've just been looking around everywhere to find like what's the most useful stuff for human beings that I can find, and then trying to weave it all together.
Great. And what are some of your current responsibilities right now?
Well, so at the moment, I'm a therapist one day a week. I work for the Open University, so I teach psychology and psychotherapy there. And then I do a bit of coaching, I do a bit of training, I do some talks, and then I do a lot of writing.
Yeah, I noticed you've published a number of books, and we'll come on to talk about that as well. So just for a bit of context for the listeners. So we were discussing just before we started the interview that I've been doing some of my own research into the future of self-help. You know, this podcast is certainly part of the kind of personal development industry, certainly for entrepreneurs and business leaders and all the different types of people that listen to the show. So, you know, I've been doing some of my own independent research to see where this industry is going, because I want to lead the way in terms of what people want and the types of information and modalities that people are preferring to use. So I found MJ's work through this research. I'm delighted to have you here to have a kind of discussion about this. I'd be kind of keen to kick us off with a kind of a discussion around your views on self-help and some of the things you've discovered in your own research. I know you've done a lot of
absolutely
work in the field.
Yeah, I've looked into the history a bit as well myself, and I mean, I'm even almost a little uncomfortable with the word self-help. I called my first self-help book an anti-self-help book. It's a self-help book around relationships. So I called it anti-self-help because I think, you know, the very word self-help suggests there's something wrong with you as an individual, yourself, that needs helping. And again, when I've been studying kind of human beings and emotions and mental health and all these things, it seems like a lot of the problem is often the messages that we're getting from wider culture rather than, you know, us as individuals. So certainly with relationships, you know, we get so many messages about romantic relationships and how we need to find the one perfect partner who's going to be everything to us. And, you know, we should meet them at a certain age and, you know, be married by a certain point and all of the points in our lives we're supposed to have. And that kind of pressure actually makes relationships a lot worse rather than better. Like, there's research that finds that people who are striving for that kind of Hollywood romance tend to have really bad relationships. And it's kind of similar in other ways. If you think about, like, you know, body image, trying to strive for a perfect body and a body ideal often makes us feel a lot worse about our bodies. And, you know, trying to be this massively successful person and perfectly happy all the time often makes us more depressed. So it's kind of a paradox, which I'm really interested in exploring and then actually locating some of the problem in our wider culture rather than in the individual.
That's really interesting, actually, because, you know, a lot of the material, I guess, out there is all about dealing with the internal game, the inner of the individual in terms of the way they think, the way they operate. But you're right. So one of the challenges I faced in business is that, particularly in this social media environment, we have such access to information, such access to other people. So we have this paradigm where it's so easy to compare yourself to others, not only in terms of perceived progress, because you definitely see the diamonds on social media and not necessarily the rough. So you don't necessarily get the true picture.
But also,
yeah,
what it does is it opens our world up to so many different things that we never had access to in the past. So as an entrepreneur, you can see all these different business models, different opportunities, and it can lead to quite an interesting experience. And one of the things I've experienced recently is, as I expand my thinking about what's possible for my business, is I look at all these different ideas, and you start to base upon your choices based upon what other people's choices are. And then there's that whole comparison piece as well, which I've talked about with a number of guests in terms of how...
Oh, have you? Yeah.
So the emotional impact of comparing yourself to others. And that comes back to the point you were making about that external forces. So when we try and rise to those external forces as opposed to actually realizing that the problem... Yeah, it's interesting. What do you think about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think social media has kind of exacerbated this. But if you look back to philosophy, the French philosopher Michel Foucault was talking about this quite a long time ago and saying that the way our culture has gone is that it's a self-monitoring culture. Mm. So the way we kind of police ourselves, he uses the example of this kind of prison where, like, there's a prison guard right in the middle of a central point of the prison. He can see into any cell at any time. And because he's doing that, everybody starts just monitoring their own behavior and policing their own behavior. And he says that, you know, our society has become like that. We're sort of encouraged constantly to monitor ourselves. Are we good enough? And compare ourselves to everyone else. And that's kind of how advertising works, right? It makes us feel like there's something wrong with us that we need to fix. So we're so busy looking at ourselves, we're not kind of looking outwards to think what might need to change about the culture. We're just trying to perfect ourselves all the time.
Wow. So, yeah, I guess, you know, a lot of the self-help material that I've come across certainly deals with that kind of not necessarily fixing yourself. That would perhaps be the deepest way of looking at it. But, you know, finding ways to adapt your behaviors, adapt your thinking. But you're right, that's all very internal. So what's the alternative?
Well, I think we can't get away from the internal. You know, it's like I'm writing a self-help book. It is going to be read by an individual person who's thinking, you know, how can I make my life better? So I'm obviously... You know, not trying to say the only thing to do is change the world. But I think what we need to maybe encourage people into is a bit more critical thinking and then a bit more compassionate thinking. So instead of like being critical against ourselves and sort of nice to everybody else, it's more about being much more compassionate towards ourselves and recognizing we are in this wider culture that's quite toxic in many ways. And so we need to kind of go easy on ourselves. Yes. and be a bit more critical of those messages we receive and, you know, think about which ones we want to buy into and which ones we actually might want to be quite critical of, you know, a bit like some feminist kind of approaches to women's magazines, for example, of being critical about the kind of ideals that are being sold there. But we can take that a lot further. Like, most of the messages we get are worth a bit of critical thinking.
Yeah, I think that's so important. You know, I had a fantastic conversation with a lady called Mandy Morris on the show, and we were talking about the power of intuition and really paying attention to your thoughts and your feelings, those internal drivers, but then having that same intuitive awareness with the external environment, the social environment, to have that level of critical thinking that you're speaking about would be really powerful, because then you can adopt the way you know, at the same time of paying attention to how you feel about something, you can also then have a look at the actual information that you're receiving and a bit more, you know, take a step back and actually evaluate, is this useful to me?
Is this for me? I think that's absolutely right. And some of the stuff that comes from kind of mindfulness, etc., about being more present goes hand in hand with this, really. For example, I'm working on a book at the moment. It's coming out in January. That's a sex advice book. Wow. And to write that sex advice book, I looked at all the other sex advice books I could find, all the best-selling ones. And they're really problematic because they kind of just assume a kind of normal sex that everybody should be striving for. It's quite a narrow vision of sex, and that's the cultural message we get about sex, is like you should be having it X many times a week, and it should be penis and vagina sex, for want of a better word, and ending in orgasm. You know, it's quite limited. So the two things you can do there that actually help people is, first of all, critical thinking outwards, which is to say, maybe there's quite a lot of different forms of sex that we could be doing, and which ones do we actually fancy having. And the same time, if we can be a bit more present to sex, instead of trying to tick certain boxes of like, oh, I should be doing this now, and you know, being very goal focused about sex, if people can just be present and tune into themselves, they tend to have a much better time. And whilst that's just one example, I think the same kind of goes for everything, really. If we can be more present to ourselves and a bit more critical of the message we receive, we actually end up being a lot more happy, doing what we love in terms of our work, having better relationships, you name it.
Absolutely. I really want to dive into that because I've got some interesting questions on that. So just to give it a little parallel point, you know, I've just spent the last few weeks really kind of reevaluating my business and my life. And I as part of that process, I had a holiday where I just removed myself from you know, normal day-to-day life. And one of the questions I asked before I went away was, you know, what you know, because I've just been what I call the warp, you know, I've been single-minded focused on what I'm creating and building. But then I wanted to come out of that warp to take to have a look, to have that critical thinking and to really evaluate, you know, what are the things I'm doing that are making an impact? What are the things actually I like and want to continue doing?
Perfect.
But then when you say that about relationships and sex specifically, and we were talking about the external environment and how, you know, preconceived notions of what's right or how the Hollywood effect. So say, for example, you know, I'm in a relationship. I've been with my partner Lizzie now for 3 years. In fact, the holiday was to celebrate that 3-year anniversary. But
congratulations.
Thank you. But of course, you know, I've got 32 years of my awareness of the external environment and my perceptions and all the references and associations that I've developed through my upbringing. And of course, then Lizzie has her own in a completely independent environment. So in a relationship sense and in a sexual sense, I'm really keen to explore this. How do you then, when you come together, you know, and you've got a completely different set of experiences, then how do you make that work? So, you know, in business, it's okay. I'm the single creator of my existence. And, you know, if I don't like something, I can change it. But in a relationship, it's not just my existence and my paradigms and my thinking that I need to consider. So how does that operate in a relationship?
Well, you're spot on, you know, and this is why I think so much of the relationship self-help literature is really problematic, because it's sort of quite simplistic and doesn't, you know, it sort of assumes that people should be able to have these easy kind of happily ever afters. And I'm like, relationships are really hard. If you look at existentialism, that's why I'm kind of into that philosophy, because, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir were having a relationship with each other for a start. And then most of their writing says relationships are really hard, you know, because, their view was like any two people or more. But, you know, even just a two people relationship, you've got all of that, you know, the two people and their different backgrounds and their different needs. And you're going to be in conflict. I think Sartre even said like conflict was just inevitable in relationships, and often you get into where one person is trying to kind of overpower the other, and so coming to something more mutual where you both support each other and each other's goals is quite a job of work, and that's why I'm really into in the relationship self-help that I write, is kind of looking at how hard that is and then exploring how we might go about doing it. But it involves, you know, things like meta communication, you know, talking about how we're going to talk. We might even have different preferences, you know, about how we converse or how we like to show our love to each other, for example. So you can find that the one person is constantly doing tasks around the house because they think that shows their love to the other person, and all the other person wants is something special, like taking out for a meal, you know. So it's that kind of thing that we don't even think about, and we have no education about in school, and we have all these Hollywood ideals of romance, and then we're in a relationship and we're like, oh, this is really hard. You know, I like to be on my own at the end of the day. My partner likes to talk about things the minute they're through the door, for example. You know, that kind of stuff is really difficult to navigate.
Absolutely. And it's one thing having the intellectual knowing of those principles. So for example, you know, some things you touched upon there, you know, I've sadly not done enough in terms of my own self-development in the area of relationships. It's all been very experiential, but I have read
some fabulous books by this Meg John Barker person.
Yes.
You could pick up.
we'll definitely be putting links in the show notes so you can explore those. But some of the principles you talked about there in terms of what I know is just love languages, and that's something I've learned about and how important that is. And even though I have that intellectual knowing, or at least believe I do, you know, I could get Lizzie in here and we could have a debate whether I do know. That would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
But in the moments when, you know, you're in that warp, like I spoke about in business, you're in flow, you're in your pattern, and all of a sudden, you know, there's an interaction in your relationship and you forget, you know, it's not that you have forgotten, it's just that your focus is elsewhere. So those patterns of those love languages, you know, someone is doing something and you're not responding to it and it causes conflict.
Yeah.
What have you learned about how to optimize these conflicts?
Well, yeah, I mean, conflicts are really tough, and I've written a number of times about, you know, how do we manage conflicts. I don't think we can avoid them. I think the first, you know, step one isn't recognizing they are inevitable and they're going to happen, and they are really hard and really painful for people because they often touch on our deepest values, you know. Yeah. And often they are about things being triggered that we may not even be aware of ourselves. So I suppose a kind of ongoing commitment to a sort of self-understanding is definitely wise, so that we can recognize, that was my button, you know, that just got pushed. And then maybe in the heat of the moment, we can't see that, but we can go afterwards and kind of sit with ourselves and think, oh, yes, that's why that was such a big deal for me. If we don't do any therapy in our lives or any kind of meditation practices or self-understanding kind of stuff, then it's very hard to know that stuff. So we just end up, well, basically we end up often blaming the other person. And that's where a kind of ongoing conflict in a relationship happens, when both people are just defending themselves and getting angry outwards at the other person. So it's taking that step to recognize that actually both people are reasonable people. Yes. And both will have good reasons for why they're getting so upset about, yes, things. And empathy is the answer. Kindness is pretty much always the answer in my book. It's like actually being willing to sit and listen to that person, even though they're driving you absolutely crazy, you know?
I hear that. And I think one of the challenges, yeah, is when it comes to conflicts, is that I think if they stack, you know, you have conflict after, yeah, conflict in a similar vein, and you take away that piece, so you think you're associating the conflict to the person rather than the misunderstanding between you. I think that's
exactly.
So how do you...
And it's about vulnerability, isn't it, as well? It's about being able to be vulnerable with another person rather than putting on our armor and defending ourselves. Usually it's where somebody's managed to find a chink and really, really got in there to something we're vulnerable about. You know, we really don't want to believe we're selfish, and they've kind of pointed out that we are, or we really don't want to think that we're a bit cowardly, and they've kind of, you know, something that's happened has revealed that about us, and we're, you know, we'd rather defend against it than acknowledging, oh, ouch, yeah, that really got to something that I worry about myself. And if we could actually open up about that vulnerability, often it would be much easier for the other person to be kind to us and to understand why this is happening. Whereas all the defensiveness, kind of, it's a bit baffling to the other person because they don't have their buttons in the same places.
And I've seen you've recently released a book on the secrets of enduring love, and that's a fascinating title, and it's very appealing.
My mate Jackie Gabb did a big survey at the Open University, and a lot of interviews about with long-term people in long-term relationships, and asking them, you know, what made it work, because it's different things for different people really in terms of what makes their relationships work. And basically that book that we wrote together was my attempt to write a self-help book on the basis of what everybody had come up with. But yeah, a lot of the stuff about conflict is in that book.
What are some of the other big lessons you learned through that process in terms of creating that enduring love?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah. A lot of it was about daily kindness to each other. That, you know, people weren't, it wasn't all about big declarations of love, and actually sex didn't come out as being that important to people, but it was a lot more about if people on an everyday basis did little things just to show the other person they were thinking of them, or that they were grateful if they did something around the house. That was quite big for people. And then I guess people being able to write their own relationship again. So people had really diverse living situations, and it was really important that they'd been able to find the one that worked for them, even if it was living separately or living more communally with people or whatever they found. You know, that sense of being able to sort of fit your life around your relationship and not feel constrained by the kind of cultural rules about how you're supposed to do it, you know, but being able to find your own way, that was really important as well.
Fantastic. Now, so yeah, I'm a big believer in terms of some of the self-help literature that I've been exposed to over the years, and the principle that you are the creator of your world, effectively.
You write your own script.
Which is very possible in a relationship too, and I find that just completely fascinating. And it's the interesting thing is, though, relationships are one of those areas where I feel, you know, when it comes to business, you know, I can walk into another business and clearly observe what's working or what's not working, or what I would like to model and adapt.
Yeah,
it's not so easy to do that with other people's relationships, you know. So
a lot of the things
I do in my business from starting this podcast, you know, back at the beginning of this year, you know, I took from other people from observing what I deemed to be a very good model to communicate a message and something I particularly enjoy because I love getting on the mic and doing things on in audio. But when it comes to relationship, so a lot of these things I can expand my business from expanding my paradigm of what's possible in the business. But how do you do that in relationships? Because you're right. We live in this very narrow tunnel, really. That's of these expectations that people have of us. How do we expand that vision so that we can deepen our relationships and bring new things, new facets, new elements into our relationships to open up, you know, all these doors that are left closed?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, the other thing that came up in that study and also in other work I've done is how important it is to kind of have more in your life than just the relationship. So nearly everybody who is having, you know, what we might think of as a successful relationship or a happy relationship, they had other things in their life as well, beyond the relationship, whether it was their kids or their religion or their work or hobbies or friends. And a community that I've looked at a lot are polyamorous and non-monogamous people who balance multiple relationships. They have multiple love relationships in their lives. And I think that we can learn a lot from people who are doing that, whether or not we're monogamous ourselves. How do you navigate your relationship and the rest of your life? Because like you say, you need that kind of other stuff going on to keep your relationship fresh and kind of keep seeing your partner as all of that they are and not just what they are to you.
So the concept of a non-monogamous relationship is a little alien to me. So let's come on to that. Could you define what that means and then, you know, some of the things that you've observed from those types of relationships?
Yeah, so it means, I mean, there's lots of different kinds. And in fact, in a way, the monogamous, non-monogamous distinction is kind of falling apart these days. Okay. So like there's people who kind of, it's like I'm going to get married and I'm going to be faithful to that person, not do anything with anyone else. But, you know, in the old days, that might have looked very exclusive, like even not even having any friends of the same gender as your partner, for example, right. Not staying friends with your ex. These days, there's more of a continuum. You know, there's a lot of people who are friends with ex-partners, for example, or definitely have a lot of other friendships in their lives. There are people who are like monogamish, Dan Savage calls it. You know, they are in a monogamous relationship, but it's okay to be a bit flirty with someone else or maybe snog somebody else occasionally. And then you've got openly non-monogamous people who actually maybe they're in a couple, but they do have sex with other people occasionally, like swinging or something, or an open relationship. And then polyamorous people are kind of at the other end of the spectrum in that they have multiple romantic partners. So they have more than one. They wouldn't just see it as like having just one relationship. They would have more than one, and they might all be at the same level.
Okay, so what
does that make sense?
It does make sense, and you know, I have not, especially the poly, how do you pronounce that?
Polyamory.
Polyamory. Yeah.
Polyamory, like multiple loves.
Yes, kind of makes sense. I've not had experience of living in that type of arrangement myself. So what are the principles that enable that type of relationship to function without?
Well, they say the mantra is communicate, communicate, communicate. Okay. So obviously there's a lot of stress on communication. And I guess a lot of the things that I've written about communication and relationship, I kind of get from there. I mean, I'm struck by a lot of my colleagues in psychology when they study people who are outside the norm, like polyamorous people or kinky people or bisexual people or whatever, that usually the question they have is, how can we explain this strange deviation from the norm? And my question is always like, flip that on its head. What can we learn? You know, what can we learn of people who are at the outer limits of how we do relationships or sex or gender? Because actually you could see them often as the pioneers, you know, in relation to, you know, monogamy is really, really difficult. There's a lot of people now writing, like Esther Perel, who writes Mating in Captivity, about how difficult it is to have the same person in your life be the person you kind of live with every day, maybe co-parent with. And also you want that person to be a fantastic lover and to keep the passion alive. And you also want that person to be like your best friend and your cheerleader. You're asking for a lot of different things all in one place. And I suppose, you know, I think that, you know, polyamory, one of the things we can get from it is that idea that maybe you get different needs met in different places and maybe that's okay. That doesn't mean to say that everybody should be polyamorous. You know, a lot of people are very happy being monogamous, but even monogamous people might think, perhaps relying on that same person for everything might be, you know, a bit impossible. What about if I get some of my emotional support met with this friend? And what about if I get, you know, some of my, get a cheerleader in my life who's, you know, a life coach or something? Just like, you know, thinking about getting different needs met from different people.
That's fascinating. And one of the things I think, looking at that type of, that category of relationships is that, you know, I've changed. You know, I'm 32 years old now. I've changed a lot since I was a teenager and, you know, first entering into the world of relationships. You know, certainly when I was in my early teens, I had a couple of relationships where I was just deeply insecure. You know, I hadn't found myself as an adult at that point, and that insecurity led to things like, you know, jealousy, irrational jealousy. When you start, you see things that aren't there. You create stories in your mind. And a lot of that has changed now as I've become more secure as a human being, and, you know, I've got to grips with owning my identity and my worth and all those kind of issues that, you know, I've talked a lot about on this podcast in terms of that inner game.
Good on you. If you got there by 32, mate, you're doing well.
Well, I'm not saying I've completed it. You know, there's no tick and move on, but it's constant evolution. But it's a long way away from where it was when I was, say, 15, 16, 17, 18. Far more secure in myself, and, you know, don't have the same, you know, jealous paranoias that I had as a teenager. But I was just thinking about this other type, you know, when you have multiple partners, how the heck does that work in terms of a, you know, you must have that, because jealousy is human. We still all experience jealousy to some degree. I would be very hard pressed to find someone who has conquered the emotion of jealousy permanently. So how does that?
Oh, absolutely. It definitely happens. I mean, I suppose some non-monogamous people will say, well, you know, it doesn't happen maybe as much as you might think. If you ask polyamorous people, like, what's the biggest challenge, they tend to say time management rather than jealousy, just to make the point of, like, it's not all about jealousy. You know, they get a bit sick about being asked that question because everybody's like, how do you manage the jealousy? But of course it happens. And I suppose what I think that they do, again, which is really helpful for everyone, whether or not you're monogamous, is that the sense of jealousy as being something that you own. So generally speaking, in our culture, there's this idea that if you're jealous, the other person's making you jealous, like, by their behavior, they shouldn't be doing that thing. And in polyamory, the sense is more, okay, I'm feeling jealous. That's revealing something useful to me about what I might be insecure about. And then maybe that's something I want to do some work on or look at a bit more. So again, a kind of mindfulness idea that maybe the thing to do with jealousy is to stay with it and figure out what it's telling you that might be useful, rather than, oh no, I'm jealous, I can't possibly feel like this, I must make that person stop doing whatever they're doing to make me jealous. Do you get the difference?
Yes, I do. That's a really great distinction. And even when you bring it back to the point you made about communication, when you have pure vulnerability and the ability to communicate well in a relationship, I think those two foundational elements, certainly from my observation of the relationships I've been part of and seeing other people's relationships, I think having mutual vulnerability and mutual ability to then communicate within that sphere of vulnerability will enable you to create a more effective relationship.
Absolutely. And recognizing that, you know, just because of you're feeling a certain way doesn't mean the other person's doing anything wrong. I suppose it's like, I kind of see it like a Venn diagram in a way of, like, you've got you and you've got the other person. And, you know, like you were saying about your relationship, you know, there's differences there. And it's about holding those differences as equally valid rather than trying to, like, you know, put your stuff on that. Okay, just because I want to do relationships like this, you've got to do them like this as well. And that it is really challenging to hold, you know, two people's stories or two people's values as equally important rather than trying to kind of get them to be a bit more like you. Or even trying to make yourself a bit more like them, which is what a lot of people do and then end up, you know, resenting it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, how do I hold on to me and them as equally valid, even in the places where we're different? You know, that's the challenge, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And this is a deep conversation because, you know, we talked about societal and environmental influences, but then, you know, in a close partnership relationship, then you spend a lot of time together. You know, we have the working day, of course, but then we have those influence of each other. And, you know, there's a phrase in influence that says, you know, those the one who is most certain is the one who wins in influencing the other person. Mm. So if someone has very certain...
That's interesting.
You know, someone has very certain viewpoints and the other person's level of certainty is a lower degree, then the person who has most certainty is more likely to influence the other person, therefore...
That's right, yeah. And it's so easy then to lose yourself in a relationship. And I think I've been on both sides of that dynamic myself, you know, of being the one that the other person tries to shape themselves, you know, in order not to lose me. Mm. And then vice versa, I've been the one who's tried to shape myself to fit another person because I've been so, you know, wanting to be what they want me to be and really enjoying, you know, a lot of that in love feeling can be, wow, they're seeing me as awesome. I must try and make myself, you know, as awesome as I can in their eyes to keep getting this awesome feeling.
Yes.
But it can flip into what you're talking about, that actually, oh, hang on a minute, 3 years down the line, I've completely lost myself, or the other person's completely lost themselves, and now we're kind of unhappy, and that doesn't really seem to be very good.
Yes.
So yeah, however we can do it, that we try and like really value the other person as they are, rather than trying to like, oh, if I could just make them, you know, eat this food or exercise a bit more, or go to bed the same time as me, or enjoy the kind of holiday I enjoy, you know, if I just tweak them a bit, then it would all be better. No, actually, you know, that's a pretty bad track to get on.
So on that point then, do you think, you know, say you're in a relationship and you're seeing all those things that perhaps cause frustration in a relationship, in that, you know, the other person holds different viewpoints or different values to yourself. Is acceptance and kindness a cure-all in that relationship that would enable that relationship to flourish? Or is it simply, would you simply say that the relationship's potentially got compatibility challenges?
Yeah, well, I would say kindness is definitely the way, but you know, when I work as a relationship therapist, I'm very clear that, you know, sadly you can't necessarily predict the outcome. So it may be that two people realize actually they're closer together than they thought they were and it's all grand, or they realize there are some differences. Like, you can sort of say that in all relationships there's going to be some points of tension where there are differences, and it's just going to come up every now and again over the relationship. And, you know, if people know that, they can be a bit more prepared for it and a bit like, oh, here it is again, you know. And so some people, you know, it's fine, their relationship will survive that. Some people are going to find out it's just too incompatible. You know, one wants kids and the other doesn't, or it's just, you know, something about one of them's values is so different from the other in a way that they just can't, you know, they can't live with that person, for example. Mm. It might be they can have another kind of relationship that they can change it into a co-parenting relationship that's not a partnership or, you know, a friendship. And sometimes it is, you know, actually this needs to end. We're not great for each other. And I think, yeah, that there's a massive existential kind of challenge of kind of looking at relationships in that real open way, if we're going to be as kind as possible to each other and acknowledge that, you know, it may be that ending is the answer. I guess I'd say, you know, in a sense, all relationships end, you know, at some point, one way or another.
By default, they have to, yeah.
Maybe we need to be a bit less scared of that. You know, maybe we need to define the success of a relationship not so much about it lasting forever, but it being, you know, bloody good in the present.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe two people change in ways that do become incompatible. You know, that's not the end of the world. It can be quite a good thing to notice that and move on and maybe have other relationships in future.
Great. I've got another question. I knew this would happen. I've gone right into relationships. This is it's a fascinating
topic.
Yeah,
it's great. I'm like, I wish I was taking notes.
Well, obviously it's all recorded, so you're fortunate.
Yeah.
So the piece here is that I would like to ask about, in terms of the work that you've done with people in relationships, what are some of the seemingly unsurmountable challenges that you've helped people overcome that were surmountable, that people would perceive perhaps it was something that would be a deal breaker, to put in simple terms? What are some of the biggest insurmountable challenges you've seen overcome?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I guess a lot of people end up coming to me with stuff around the monogamy, non-monogamy. So I think, yeah, sexual incompatibility is often seen as insurmountable. And I think quite often, again, it's about opening up that idea of what do we mean by sex. So it might be that two people are sort of sexually incompatible in the sense of like they're not necessarily both into this kind of quite constrained idea of what sex is. Yeah. But if they open up to all possible sexual experiences, they realize they both really enjoy sharing fantasies or watching porn or mutual masturbation or something else. So it's, that's not insurmountable. Or it might be they find, you know, one of them's not sexual at all and the other is, and there's other ways of that person getting their sexual needs met, either through solo sex or through opening up the relationship. So, yeah, I guess it's about thinking, you know, outside of the small, like, ideal of what's normal. And then you could say the same for many other problems, like financial incompatibility would be similar. You could think, oh, no, this is, you know, this can't possibly work. This person earns money and the other one doesn't. And that's causing a massive load of stress. Again, if you can think a bit laterally about it, there might be other ways of taking the pressure off by changing the living situation, for example. So that makes sense.
Yeah,
so you're kind of opening up a bit more.
But you know, both the physical side and the financial side are both sensitive, potentially sensitive areas of discussion,
yeah.
Especially when we look at preconditioning and what we're expected to talk about and the level of depth that we can go into conversation, especially when it comes to I'd say physical more so than finance can be a taboo subject, but physical, if you've got that,
I know,
if you've got that challenge,
isn't it curious that, you know, the very person it's often hardest to talk about sex with is the person we're having sex with.
Totally.
I always think that's, you know, like, we'll go out with our mates and talk about sex, and then we'll come around and we can't possibly talk about sex with this person whose body has been inside my body, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
It's so weird in a way, but it's true. It's really, it's so vulnerable, I think. That's the thing. It's just such vulnerable territory. So I guess in my work in this area, I'm working with sex educator Justin Hancock, who runs BISH UK, which is, he mostly works with young people, and we're working together to do a lot of writing, blogging and podcasts and things around this whole area, just to kind of try and open up the topic so people can feel a bit more comfortable talking about it, really. And, you know, that it doesn't have to be that way. You know, it really is kind of fine to talk about sex.
Yeah.
But again, we're just not taught how. We're not given any language for it, you know.
We're totally not taught how. And it is fascinating. I did a slight side tangent, but my old housemate, this is back in just post-university years, I went to drop something off at his house and where his girlfriend, himself and his girlfriend lived. And I stayed there for a while to chat, and then she was having all the girls around for this girly night.
Yeah.
And they ended up saying, oh, do you want another drink? So I had another drink. Yeah, stay a drink. And before you know it, I was just immersed into this girl's night out.
Yeah.
And the level of conversation they had,
right,
around their physical relationships was way beyond what I'd ever had of any of my male friends. I was fascinated. I said, guys, you're male to male, or masculine to masculine, male to male, however you want to look at it, we don't talk in this level. So you're right.
I think there is a little bit less of a taboo in talking about it between female friends, but as you say, it's such a shame. You know, they're not talking to their partners often at that level of intimacy.
But then how do you break down the barrier? Because that's the key. You know, if you can get to that vulnerability, what would you perceive?
Well, again, I think we need to get rid of this idea of normal sex. I think that's the problem. One study recently found, the NatCell study, the big survey about sex in this country, it found that around 50% of people had a sexual dysfunction. I was like, that's ridiculous.
Wow.
And the reason why is because we have this very narrow model of sex, which means, like, if the penis doesn't get erect, if the vagina can't be penetrated, if people don't reach an orgasm, then somehow you've got a dysfunction. But, like, there's so many other things you can do that don't require erections or penetration of that particular part of the body. You know, if we just expanded it out, then, you know, it wouldn't be a failure. And people are just, you know, they're having sex and they're just kind of bombarded with these messages and thinking, like, oh, you know, am I doing it right? When should I start doing this? What if they think I'm a freak? You know, what if I lose my erection? What if, you know, it's just this kind of anxiety level. And in long-term relationships, I think it can get even harder because there's so much, like, weight on the, like, oh, I've got to prove that I desire this person, and I've got to, you know, keep it exciting, and I've got to show, you know, that I can perform sexually. It's a lot of pressure.
Mm. I think this is a good point, because I think that this probably brings our conversation full circle, because I think what's required to create that is that level of being truly authentic. You're being vulnerable enough to be truly authentically yourself and staying true to your identity, and being open to, you know, developing your identity, because, you know, if you close the doors to everything, you'll never learn about some of the marvelous wonders of the world, but staying true to that authentic self. And if you take that into business, you take it into your relationships, you take it into your health, and you're able to maintain that sense of self and the identity that you hold, then you have a much more fulfilling, and if you're able to, in relationships, I believe, if you're able to openly discuss that sense of self in who you are as a human being, but also in the physical sense and every other facet that makes up a relationship, then I think you can probably have much deeper relationships. I'm interested to explore that. But
I agree. It's so interesting to hear that these ideas kind of resonate with you when you're coming from such a different area in terms of business and entrepreneurship, but yet you're saying it's kind of the same there. It's like, if we can be vulnerable, if we can kind of know ourselves pretty well, and if we can put ourselves out there and say kind of, this is me, rather than trying to wear a mask all the time or pretend to be something else, that leads to better everything. You know, we're better creators, we're better work colleagues, we're better friends, better relationships, better sex, you know, the whole thing.
Absolutely. So bringing us full circle then, in terms of taking this forward in terms of self-development and self-help and whatever badge or label you want to give it. I love the anti-self-help. That's great. I've seen a couple of people using that kind of terminology. I think there's a gentleman called Oliver Berkman who does some great stuff on.
Love Oliver Berkman. Yeah.
And then people like Mark Manson, and more recently people like Dan Meredith, who are just kind of, you know, to say, giving the middle finger to the traditional self-help.
Yeah, it's great.
So what does the future hold? You know, what do you think this kind of genre of anti-self-help will bring?
Well, I hope that that those of us who work in this area can keep producing, you know, books and other materials looking at different areas of our life and applying this idea. And I do hope that we can keep balancing the critical thinking with compassion as well, because it's easy to just have a pop, you know, and like have a real go at the self-help industry without actually offering much in its place, or just being kind of mean. And I don't think that gets us very far either. So I think it's about trying to be compassionate about the place we've got to in our culture, but also thinking like, yeah, how might we shift it in directions that would actually make people happier, and like everyone as well, not just the people who fit nicely inside of normal, but absolutely, you know, but actually everybody. And the thing I've just finished recently that just got published is actually a comic book guide to queer.
Okay.
And queer is like a whole load of ideas, which is about people being outside of normal, particularly in relation to gender and sexuality, but in other ways as well. So basically, I was trying to do like a comic introduction to all those ideas of why we might need to keep rethinking this idea of normal and why it's so good to be normal. And that's, I guess that's another thing that I think for the future is that we need to think about different materials as well, that it's not just about producing books, because not everybody's into books, but they might be into comics, or they might be into podcasts or animations. So we need to get the ideas out in a number of different ways, as well as making sure that we write about those ideas.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the way people consume information is changing, and this fast-paced environment we live in means that, you know, short-form content is probably, you know, is required to get someone's attention amongst a sea of competing devices or other long-form content. But then when people enter into a world, then they can then take in the longer-form content. But also, I think that the human experience is still, you know, the person-to-person experience is still one of the most powerful. So in my own exploration of, you know, personal development, self-help, I believe that, you know, I believe that the seminar industry has probably deteriorated due to the financial circumstances more than people's desire to connect person to person. You know, I was at a fantastic 2-day event over the weekend in London, and you know, you can't beat that in-person interaction. You know, networking with other people, sharing ideas, sharing stories, building connections, and even when you're watching someone speak from stage, every nuance of their communication you can absorb, which you can't get from an audiobook or a podcast. You know, I try and express myself fully through tonality and all different things through this modality, but there's nothing beats being in that in-person environment. So I think in order to kind of create some of these larger scale changes in the thought processes that, you know, we've been speaking about, I think the in-person event is where real change, the immersion, what I call immersion experiences, where You know, you're actually subjecting people to ideas and thought processes at a much more deeper level. I find that that's where you can
I like that. Yeah. And I think, yeah, absolutely. And a lot of actually what I end up doing comes out of my work, the workshops I've run and the seminars that I've done as well. It's interesting you mentioned that because, yeah, you're right. That's often where some of the best ideas come together and also where people really feel that they're changing by actually having that experiential kind of thing happen rather than just reading about something.
Actually the guy whose seminar I was at the weekend, this guy called Lazo Freeman, he has a company called Body Transformation Academy, and he works with fitness professionals to help them to upgrade their fitness practices, and a lot of that really is mindset. It's the inner game and the, you know, people's self-worth and the way they perceive themselves. But so he works with the trainers to help with their mindset. But then, of course, in doing that, he's teaching them the principles so they can do the same with their clients. Because, you know, when it comes to physical conditions, a lot of it is down to inner self-worth and the way people see themselves. And again, some of the stuff we've talked about, probably a lot of the stuff we've talked about in terms of those external expectations of what, well, especially physically when it comes to the magazines and the TV and advertisements. So he's doing a lot of work on the inner game.
Like ironically, the messages we get about our body looking a certain way often makes us like disconnect from our bodies. Whereas, you know, that somebody like that will tell you you've got to connect to your body and, you know, understand it better and feel it and want to, you know, and then want to be physically active, not just because you're trying to make it look a certain way, but because you're kind of right in your body and wanting to, you know, keep it fit and healthy, I suppose.
Absolutely. So before we kind of come to the end of the interview, I'm interested to find out a little bit more about your book. So Rewriting the Rules. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Yeah, so that's the anti-self-help book about relationships.
I love the title.
And basically it takes you through kind of how to figure out where you're at in terms of sex, gender, attraction, communication, conflict, monogamy, breakups, all of these relationship topics. And the important thing about it is there's no directiveness. It's not saying you should do it like this. It's kind of helping you to think through, well, what are the messages we receive? Which ones do we want to buy into? Which ones do we want to be questioning? If we do question them, how might we want to do it differently? And also what would it look like to get beyond rules entirely in one of those areas? So it's kind of it's sort of like a guide helping the reader find their own place in terms of relationships.
Amazing. And then moving into the secrets of enduring love, then how does that differ from the first book?
So like I said, that was the one that was based on the project about long-term relationships. So it's really asking people in long-term relationships what works for them and giving the reader a sense of that diversity of ways of doing relationships. So it's got lots of quotes in from people describing their own experiences and some stats as well. And then a lot of these ideas that you were mentioning, like that Gary Chapman's idea of the love language is in there and metacommunication is in there. So really all of the ideas I found helpful, I put in that book.
Fantastic. That's fascinating. And then what's coming up next for you?
So the queer comic is just out. So if you want to know anything about queer, then you can buy, that's Queer, A Graphic History, it's called, and it's in comic book form. And then Justin Hancock and me, our book called Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To. That one is coming out in January next year. And we're also, actually, it's really helpful being part of a podcast because we're actually going to do a podcast around our book, which is going to be on our website. It's going to be called megjohnandjustin.com.
Nice.
So if you go there now, there's not much content, but it should be up in the next couple of weeks with some podcasts and some zines that people can download, some animated shorts, all kinds of things we're putting up there.
Fantastic. So I just want to transition now into the final round of the Unstoppable Show. I always ask three quick fire questions to close the episode. Get ready to think on your feet. So the first question is, and this has changed slightly somewhat over the last couple of weeks. I used to ask, what advice would you give your younger self? But I still ask that, but the first, I reverse it a little bit. So I think about a younger version of yourself. It could be childhood, it could be teenage, it could be a few years younger than you are now. What would the younger version of yourself say to you now? What advice would the younger version of yourself give to you now?
Well, it's interesting. I think that me now and my very much younger self as a child would probably give the same advice to like the teenage and early adult version of me, which would be stop trying to figure out what people want you to be and trying to be that, and you're okay as you are, basically.
Amazing.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's powerful advice. And that's the reason I asked that question, because it often draws out some of the most powerful life lessons that my guests have experienced. So
yeah,
that's a great answer.
I think I knew it right at the start, but then I forgot it for a few years or a few decades.
Amazing. Great lesson. Mm. And I'm going to ask you again the second question. I'm going to ask slightly differently as well, on the basis that today I listened to an interview with a guy, Tim Ferriss was interviewing a guy called Derek Sivers, who founded CD Baby. And the question he was asked was, what's the number one person, entrepreneurial person, who's inspired you? And he rejected the notion of giving the answer of the first person, because you typically think of the normal person. You'd think of like Richard Branson. It's just, if you ask, think of a famous classical musician, you'd think of Mozart. So it doesn't encourage any level of thought. So I'm going to ask you the same question he asked back, which is, what's the third most impactful book that you've ever read?
The third.
so you're welcome actually, to tell me the first and second as well, if you like.
Well, it's kind of super easy, I suppose, because actually probably every day I listen to a particular writer and read her books. So it's kind of like 1, 2, and 3 would be her, really, given that I engage with her every single day, which is Pema Chodron.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of her. No. She's a Buddhist writer. But she writes self-help style books from a Buddhist perspective.
Wow.
And nearly everything we've talked about in this program is in there.
Wow.
Her books have amazing titles like When Things Fall Apart and The Places That Scare You. And they're all about just having to how to navigate life really with compassion towards yourself and others. So yeah, I'm going to go for Pema Chodron.
Amazing. And then finally, the final question I asked every single guest, no matter what, is what does it mean to be unstoppable to you?
I wanted to come up with a cute answer in a way that maybe it means knowing when to stop. Going back to that idea of being present, that it's really good to pause. Like you said, that sense of going away on holiday and taking that time to pause and think about where you are. So maybe being unstoppable is about knowing when to stop.
I love that. And that's probably been one of the most powerful lessons I've learned in the last few months, is taking that time out to really reflect. It's so easy when you're wrapped up in the day to day. Just got to take a step back. Like, on a daily, don't wait until the holiday. I'm scheduling in.
Every day, yeah. Put it, that's it for me. It's every morning.
Me
just
time.
An hour to myself. Do it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, MJ, Megjohn, thank you so much for unleashing your greatness on the show today and sharing all of your insights and practical knowledge and advice based upon all the things that you've studied. It's been a fascinating conversation. All of the different books that we've talked about and some of the papers that you've referenced, we'll put all of that in the show notes so the listeners can get access to those things. The final thing for me to ask you is, for the listeners who have been tuned in with us today, what is the best way for them to find out more about your work? Where can they go to learn about you, and where should we send people to find out?
That's just my website, which is www.megjohnbarker.com. And I'm also Meg John Barker on Twitter, and it auto tweets everything. I've just had my website revamped, so it's all looking pretty shiny over there.
If you go there. Yeah, it's very different to when I first read it. So that's cool. It looks great.
Yeah, it's right in the process. So if it looks a bit funny for a few days, don't worry about it. It's getting there.
Awesome. Well, MJ, thank you so much again once more. It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to sharing the episode of The Unstoppable Tribe.
Thank you again, MJ. I found this episode absolutely fascinating, with loads of practical insights and takeaways, and I hope that you do too. Now, I want to personally invest more time into mastering this incredibly important area. I do live by the belief that we can have it all. However, having it all takes work and constant development, and relationships are absolutely no exception to the rule. So I'll be seeking other masters to come and share their wisdom with us as well as sharing my own insights along the way. But that's it. We are done for this week. I do encourage you to come and subscribe to the blog at danjgregory.com if you have not done so already. I'm going to be bringing so much more to the table in 2017, so I do not want you to miss a beat. And on that note, please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app to stay right up to speed. And if you enjoy the show, why not share it with others? Tag me in your post on Instagram and Facebook for a shout out on the show. I'll be delighted for you to do that, and I'll be absolutely delighted to reciprocate as well. So I'll be back on Monday with a long-awaited solo round, and for the rest of this month of February, we're going to be focusing on mastering business and marketing, and I have so many titans lined up that it's absolutely ridiculous. It's going to be a great month. So let's get ready for a powerful month ahead. February is on, the new year is underway. Until next time, go out there, unleash your greatness, build your empire, and make your impact. You are unstoppable.